My name is Caleb Lindquist, and I will be reading for you today. So our first story today is titled Book Puts Together Pieces on Riverton Family by Pat Sangemino from the Lincoln Journal Star. Joshua Hawes is not a historian, nor is he a genealogist, and if you asked him, he'd tell you that he's not an author either. Officially, he's a reading teacher at Loeffler Middle School in Lincoln, Nebraska, but boxes and boxes of letters and old photos found in the attic of the house that he and his wife, Sarah, rent, conveniently, located next door to Loeffler, made for a time-consuming journey through history that charted a family's lineage and at times sent the couple down numerous rabbit holes in search of piecing together the past. And in the process, Joshua became all of these things: a historian, a genealogist, and yes, an author. "It's been a puzzle for us to put together," Joshua Hawes said. "And after years of fitting together pieces of charting a family's genealogy back to 1870 and a small town in Iowa, Riverton, a Fairmont County community with a current population of 245, previously known as Riverton City, in a heyday that boasted hundreds more residents, Hawes opted to self-publish a book that features the letters. Much, much love, and please write an Iowa family story in letters in 1875 through 1958. Does its best to chart the family history of the Smith family, which had one branch migrate to Lincoln and thus explains how the letters got there. I just thought it was about time," Joshua Hawes said. "Something clicked in my head and I need to actually do this in a methodical way and not just to have it continuing to sit around." That was the point where he decided he needed to preserve the words on each letter, some of which even were beginning to fade, so he typed each one into a computer file. By the time he was finished, he had volumes of letters, enough for a book, which he organized based on branches of the Smith's family tree. The words are sometimes mundane, sometimes lively, and at times filled with love and the excitement that comes with new romance. "They provide a taste of the era," said Joshua Hawes, who adds that the stereotypical image of a 19th century rural Americans, staid serious folks, a la Grant Wood's American Gothic, don't always tell the whole story. The truth, of course, is that people in all times and places have recognizably human experiences and emotions, he said. This is naturally the case in this remarkable series of letters and documents. The subjects and writers of this collection of letters go through the ups and downs of life. They cope with the deaths from infectious diseases like tuberculosis and smallpox. They experience jealousy, pride, and frustration, as well as sympathy, joy, and humor. They are products of their historical time and place, Joshua Hawes said. Joshua and Sarah Hawes have no doubt that they would have loved to have known Marion Stubbs, who died in 1981 after living in the house, in which they now reside in the corner of 48th and C Streets. Marion Stubbs lived there with her husband, Therold Franklin, or T.F., Stubbs. She was a teacher and a drama enthusiast who performed at Riverton High School and would eventually become the drama teacher there. She would give up her teaching career to tour the country with her husband, who was a traveling shoe salesman. Her letters indicate that she had a great sense of humor and a way with words, not all of them approved by Merriam-Webster. For example, many of her letters included the word swelligent, a combination of someone being swell, a good person, and intelligent. When Marion couldn't think of a word to match a situation, she simply invented one, Joshua Hawes said. Marion was born in 1908 to Lyman and Mary Morgan, and the Hawses surmised she was the family historian, the person who wrote countless letters to the family members and kept the ones she received for posterity. Her letters went back three generations. Perhaps the most priceless among them were the courtship letters written between her parents between 1899 and 1902. She also had stacks of letters written by her maternal grandparents, Emmanuel Smith and Althea Axline, during their courtship in the 1870s. In addition, there were letters written by her maternal aunt, Vera Smith, and Vera's husband, William, as well as the letters sent by her maternal uncle, Coleman Smith, from his service in the U.S. Navy. Most of the letters come from small towns in Iowa, Kansas, and Nebraska, but some come far away as Cuba and India. And with that vast assortments of letters, photos, and newspaper clippings. The Hawses begin piercing together the history of a family they have never met, nor had ever heard of prior to moving into their Lincoln home in 2015. The project was a good hobby for Joshua and Sarah, especially because they'd spent years charting their own family histories. They'd admit for their own family charting was anticlimactic because they came from families that were tied to the Mormon church and thus had already been mapped. I have a great family history, but it has been very thoroughly documented. There's no stone unturned, said Sarah Hawes. Essentially, all of family history genealogy work has been done for us. There's been nothing to discover. Her own family, she admitted, has had isolated instances of polygamy, which causes some uneasiness in that regard. There was some certain security in charting another family's tree, and that security eventually led to a familiarity, they said. I feel like I know them, Joshua Hawes said. As he said that, his wife concurred by holding up a photo of an obscure member of the Smith family. I know that this is Priscilla, Sarah Hawes said. But it doesn't say on the photo, but I know it's her. She's immersed herself in a family that once meant nothing to her. But as their history project got more intricate, the Hawses found themselves making the 74-mile trek to Riverton, the house that Lyman and Mary raised Marion and her sister Madeline, 16 years younger, in still stands. Perhaps it's Marion's life journey, her trek that would eventually land her in Lincoln, that makes this story most compelling. After marrying T.F. Stubbs, she quit her teaching job to ride along with her husband as he sold shoes nationwide. Many of her letters come from the road. It wasn't long before T.F. Stubbs changed careers and began managing radio stations, one in Shenandoah, Iowa, and the other in Lincoln, which prompted their move to the capital city. They moved into the house on 48th Street that once was the home to legendary University of Nebraska track coach Ed Weir, while T.F. Stubbs managed KFNF, and his wife entertained the listenership by singing on the air. T.F. was killed in a car crash in 1958. Marion stayed in the house until her death in 1981. It was eventually sold to Mary Woodward, who discovered the treasure trove of history and worked to preserve it until Joshua and Sarah Hawes pieced together the family tree. It has actually brought them closer, they say. I'm always reading things to Sarah, Joshua said. I'm like, listen to this. You've got to hear this. I'm constantly reading things to her from the letters. It's just been fun. It's been a bonding thing for us. It's something that we really have been able to share as an activity. And that is the end of the first story. This next story is called Biden Meets with Leaders. The President Says U.S. Commitment Ironclad in Indo-Pacific Region by Amir Medhandi from Associated Press. President Joe Biden said that U.S. defense commitment to Indo-Pacific allies was ironclad as he gathered Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. and Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida at the White House on Thursday in the midst of growing concern about provocative Chinese military actions. The U.S. and the Philippines have had a mutual treaty in place for more than 70 years. Biden's reinforcement of the American commitment comes amidst skirmishes between the Philippine and Chinese Coast Guards and the disputed South China Sea. The United States defense commitments to Japan and to the Philippines are ironclad. They're ironclad, Biden said, as he began the three-way talks at the White House. As I said before, any attack on Philippine aircraft vessels or armed forces in the South China Sea would invoke our mutual defense treaty. The White House billed the first ever Triterial Summit with Japan and the Philippines as a potent response to China's intimidation attempts, and said it would send a message that China is the outlier in the neighborhood, an administration official said. The White House said Biden and Marcos during the talks and underscored their commitment to international law in the South China Sea and reaffirmed their country's treaty obligations to defend each other. The leaders also announced joint patrols of the Indo-Pacific this year, a follow-up on law enforcement drills last year by the allies near the disputed sea. The summit came a day after Biden held one-on-one talks with Kishida and feted the Japanese premier with a glitzy state dinner and diplomatic honor to recognize Tokyo's growing clout on the global stage. It was also designed as a signal that the Democratic administration remains determined to build a latticework of alliances in the Indo-Pacific amid Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza and Russian invasion of Ukraine. Biden also hosted Marcos for a private meeting ahead of the scheduled three-way talks. Today's summit is an opportunity to defend the future that we want and how we intend to achieve it together, Marcos said. The summit also had a large economic component with several major U.S.-based companies announcing investments in the Philippines, administration officials said. The new deals came after the Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo visited Manila last month to announce more than $1 billion in new investment by American companies in the Philippines. My next story will be Court Hears Case on Trans Ban. Arkansas intact did the nation's first limits on gender-affirming care. By Andrew DeMillo and Jim Salter from Associated Press, St. Louis. Arguments before a federal appeals court that will consider whether to reinstate Arkansas's first-in-the-nation ban on gender-affirming care for minors focused on Thursday whether it or similar restrictions adopted by two dozen states discriminate on basis of sex. 10 judges with the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in St. Louis heard arguments over a judge's ruling last year that struck down the ban as unconstitutional. The 2021 law would prohibit doctors from providing gender-affirming hormone treatment, puberty blockers, or surgery to anyone under 18. An attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union, which challenged the law on behalf of four transgender youths and their parents, said that the restriction infringes on the long-standing rights of parents to make the decisions about their children's medical care. Arkansas believed that the government knew better than the loving parents in this case what was for the best for their minor children. Chase Strangio, Deputy Director for Transgender Justice for the ACLU's LGBTQ and HIV Project, told the court, that burdens the long-standing rights of parents to direct the medical care for their children. At least 24 states have adopted laws restricting or banning gender-affirming medical care for minors, and most of those face lawsuits. The restrictions on health care are a part of a larger backlash against transgender rights, touching on everything from bathroom access to participation in sports. The 43-minute hearing on the Arkansas law drew a panicked audience that included the actor Elliot Page, who filled a brief asking the court to uphold last year's ruling. Dylan Jacobs, the Deputy Solicitor General for Arkansas, argued that the law doesn't discriminate based on sex because it bans the treatments for a specific purpose. Minors may be prescribed testosterone for any purpose other than gender transition under the statute, Jacobs said. The full court, rather than a three-judge panel, heard the case after a request by Arkansas's Republican Attorney General Tim Griffin. The move could speed up the case's march towards the U.S. Supreme Court, which was asked to block similar laws in Kentucky and Tennessee. It is unclear when the Eighth Circuit will make its ruling. Chief Judge Stephen Colleton said that it would be an issue decision in due course. I will now be reading from the Briefly column. So I will be starting with a little snippet called Brawl. A fight broke out in a New Orleans courtroom Thursday when Joseph Washington pleaded guilty to murdering his three children in an arson house fire last year. A woman related to the children attacked him, and other relatives joined in before deputies restored order. One arrest was reported. NBC raid. Mexico's president said Thursday his country wants the United Nations to suspend Ecuador from the world body as a part of a complaint to the top of the UN court over Ecuador's police raid last week on the Mexican embassy in Quito. Aid. House Speaker Mike Johnson is negotiating with the White House to advocate aid for Ukraine and Israel in a deal that would deviate from a $95 billion Senate package and include several GOP demands, House Republican leader Steve Scalise said Thursday. Grants. The Biden administration ordered $830 million in grants Thursday to fund 80 projects to toughen aging U.S. infrastructure against the impacts of climate change. Oil. In a move environmentalists called betrayal, the Biden administration approved the construction of a deepwater oil export terminal this week off the Texas coast that would be the largest of its kind in the U.S. Immigration. Authorities in the Dominican Republic said Thursday they launched an investigation after an immigration officer was accused of raping a 14-year-old girl. And that is all in the briefly column from the Associated Press. My next story is football legend's legacy defined by murder trial. This is technically an obituary for O.J. Simpson, from Ken Ritter from the Associated Press. O.J. Simpson, the decorated football superstar and Hollywood actor who was acquitted of charges he killed his former wife and her friend, but later found liable in a separate civil trial, has died. He was 76. The family announced on Simpson's official X account that he died Wednesday of prostate cancer. He died in Las Vegas, officials said Thursday. Simpson earned fame, fortune, and adulation through football and show business, but his legacy was forever changed by the June 1994 knife slayings of his ex-wife Nicole Brown Simpson and her friend Ronald Goldman in Los Angeles. Goldman's father Fred and his sister Kim released a statement acknowledging that the hope for true accountability has ended. The news of Ron's killers passing away is a mixed bag of complicated emotions and reminds us that the journey through grief is not linear, they wrote. Live TV coverage of his arrest after a famous slow speed chase marked a stunning fall from grace for the sports hero. He seemed to transcend racial barriers as the star Trojans tailback for college football's powerful University of Southern California in the late 60s, as a rental car ad pitchman rushing through airports in the late 1970s, and as the husband of a blonde, blue-eyed high school homecoming queen in the 1980s. I'm not black, I'm OJ, he liked to tell his friends. The public was mesmerized by his trial of the century on live TV. His case sparked debates on race, gender, domestic abuse, celebrity justice, and police misconduct. A criminal court jury found him not guilty of murder in 1995, but a separate civil trial jury found him liable in 1997 for the deaths and ordered him to pay $33.5 million to family members of Brown and Goldman. A decade later, still shadowed by the California wrongful death judgment, Simpson led five men he barely knew into a confrontation with two sports memorabilia dealers in a cramped Las Vegas hotel room. Two men with Simpson had guns. A jury convicted Simpson of armed robbery and other felonies. Imprisoned at the age of 61, he served 9 years in a remote northern Nevada prison, including a stint as a gym janitor. He was not contrite when he was released on parole in October 2017. The parole board heard him insist yet again that he was only trying to revive sports memorabilia and his family heirloom stolen from him after his criminal trial in Los Angeles. I've basically spent a conflict-free life, you know, said Simpson, whose parole ended in late 2021. Public fascination with Simpson never faded. Many debated if he was punished in Las Vegas for his acquittal in Los Angeles in 2016. He was the subject for both an FX Ministries and five-part ESPN documentary. Simpson played 11 NFL seasons, 9 of them with the Buffalo Bills, where he became known as the Juice while running behind an offensive line as the Electric Company. He won 4 NFL rushing titles, rushed for 11,236 yards in his career, scored 76 touchdowns, and played in 5 Pro Bowls. His best season was 1973 when he ran for 2,003 yards, the first running back to break the 2,000-yard line rushing mark. I was a part of history of the game, he said years later, recalling that season. If I did nothing else in my life, I've made my mark. We don't need to go back and relive the worst days of our lives, he told the AP 25 years after the double slayings. The subject of the moment is the subject I will never revisit again. My next story is ex-Otani interpreter charged around the majors. Federal authorities charged for the former longtime interpreter for Los Angeles Dodgers star Shohei Ohtani on Thursday with federal bank fraud, alleging he stole more than $16 million from the Japanese sensation to cover gambling bets and debts. Interpreter Ieppi Mitsuhara, a constant presence besides Ohtani in baseball stadiums across the country since 2018, abused the two-way player's trust in him and exploited the language barrier to plunder a bank account that only he could have access to, prosecutors said. U.S. Attorney Martin Estrada said Mitsuhara was so intertwined in Ohtani's life and career that he became the star's de facto manager. The role enabled him to withdraw money from the account, at times lying and impersonating Ohtani to bank employees to finance his insatiable appetite for illegal sports betting. Estrada said there is no evidence that Ohtani was aware of his interpreter's actions. Mitsuhara faces up to 30 years in federal prison if he's convicted of a single count of bank fraud. This is from the section My Pet World, Alternatives to Declawing Cats, by Kathy M. Rosenthal. Dear Kathy, my 22-year-old cat died in December. I adopted a 14-month kitten from our local shelter. I signed a no-declaw agreement, but this kitten is crazy in love with clawing me. Why? What should I do? I don't want to live out much more time with big bleeding scratches almost everywhere on my body. Dear No Name, I want to extend my condolences for the loss of your 22-year-old cat, but it's been so long since you've had a kitten in the house. It's important to remember that kittens and puppies are akin to babies who need to learn manners and house rules. Before I offer suggestions on redirecting your kitten's behavior, however, it is crucial to understand why declawing is not recommended. Declawing involves amputating a cat's toes at the last joint, leading to a long-term pain, phantom pain, like those missing a limb might experience, and behavioral issues. Cats rely on their claws for defense and natural behaviors like stretching and marking territory. Removing their claws can result in frustration at not being able to protect themselves, leading to possible negative behaviors like biting. A cat may also avoid a litter box due to pain because it simply feels different under their paws. Through the years, many pet owners tell me that they regret getting their cat declawed. I share their thoughts and hope to persuade you not to declaw your cat. Instead, there are human ways to redirect your cat's natural behaviors. When a cat stretches your arms, it's usually a sign of anxiety, agitation, or overstimulation. It may come from pent-up energy on their part or overhandling or using one's hands during playtime on your part. Cats exhibit various body language cues indicating when to leave them alone. Always let the cat initiate contact with you and respect their boundaries. Also, get a feline pheromone collar for your kitty and spray feline pheromones on your clothing each day. These may help your cat relax and learn to accept more contact from you. I would be remiss if I didn't mention to you and others humane alternatives to declawing in order to protect furniture. First, provide multiple scratching posts made of different materials such as sisal, cardboard, wood, or carpet, accommodating both vertical and horizontal structures to determine your cat's preferences. Encourage and train your kitten to use those posts by gently guiding them to the post when they scratch where they shouldn't, or by enticing them with treats left at the base or rubbing the scratching post with catnip. Reward them with treats or praise when they use them. Second, use sticky paws tape on furniture to discourage your cat from use, and soft paws nail caps on your cat's nails to protect you and your furniture. Third, learn how to trim your kitten's claws to minimize their sharpness. Online tutorials are readily available, or your veterinarian can offer guidance. Finally, cats require a lot of physical and mental enrichment. Provide plenty of toys, climbing structures like cat trees, and interactive playtime to reduce mental and physical anxiety. Training a kitten to use appropriate scratching services takes time and patience, so please reconsider getting your cat declawed and try these suggestions instead. With consistency and persistence, you can successfully redirect their behavior without subjecting your cat to the trauma of the surgery. Kathy M. Rosenthal is a longtime animal advocate, author, columnist, and pet expert who has more than 25 years in the animal welfare field. Send your pet stories, tips to Kathy at petpundit.com. Please include your name, city, and state. All right, so this is Jack Black enjoys each return to Kung Fu Panda from the Entertainment Brief section. Jack Black's desire to put on a show keeps him coming back to the Kung Fu Panda franchise. The 54-year-old actor said that he's always open to featuring in films that have good stories. Speaking to the Metro newspaper, Black said, "You know, I'd love to put on a show, and if someone's got a good idea for a new story, I'm always down, whether it be Kung Fu Panda, New Journey, or any kind of cool movie. I like to tell stories. The School of Rockstar revealed that he intends to take inspiration from late Robin Williams as the genie in Aladdin and Steve Carell as Gru in Despicable Me franchise when it comes to voice roles. Black explained, "That's probably my favorite Robin Williams performance. His voice performance in Aladdin, he crushed that role so hard, and he had some rad singing in there as well. He was a huge inspiration for me for my voice acting career. Yeah, that's probably up at the top of the mountain for me." My next story is called New Attempt at Relief: What to Know About Biden's Latest Student Loan Cancellation Plan, by Colin Binkley, Associated Press. President Joe Biden is taking another shot at student loan cancellation, hoping to deliver on key campaign promise that he has so far failed to fulfill. Biden recently detailed a proposal that would cancel at least some debt for more than 30 million Americans. It's been in the works for months after the Supreme Court had rejected Biden's first try at mass cancellation. Here's what to know about the new plan. How is this different from Biden's first plan? Biden's first attempt at widespread student loan cancellation would have erased $10,000 for borrowers with yearly incomes of up to $125,000 plus an additional $10,000 if they received federal Pell grants for low-income students. It was estimated to cost $400 billion and cancel at least some student debt for more than 40 million people. The Supreme Court rejected that plan last year, saying Biden overstepped his authority. The new plan uses a different legal justification, the Higher Education Act, which allows the Security of Education to waive student loan debt in certain cases. The Education Department has been going through a federal rulemaking process to clarify how the secretary can invoke the new authority. The new plan targets five categories of borrowers, focusing on those believed to be in the greatest need of help. It would provide relief to an estimated 30 million borrowers. The administration has not said how much the plan would cost. So who is eligible? Biden's new proposal would offer cancellation to five categories of borrowers. The widest reaching provisions aims to reset student loan balances for borrowers who have seen their debt grow because of unpaid interest. It can cancel to $20,000 in interest for Americans who now owe more than they originally borrowed. That cap wouldn't apply for individuals who make less than $120,000 a year, or couples who earn less than $240,000 and also are enrolled in an income-driven repayment plan. The Education Department says 25 million people would be eligible for that relief, including 23 million who would get their interest erased entirely. Borrowers who are eligible for other federal forgiveness programs but haven't applied would also get their loans canceled under the new proposal. It applies to the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program and income-driven repayment plans, among others. An estimated 2 million people would be eligible for that help. All debt would be canceled for borrowers who have been repaying their undergraduate loans for 20 years or more, or 25 years for those with graduate school debt. The Biden administration says it would erase loans for more than 2 million people. Those who attend college programs of low financial value would be eligible for forgiveness. The plan would cancel debt for borrowers who went to the institutions that lost eligibility for federal education funding because they cheated students. It would also cancel loans for people who went to college programs that left graduates with low incomes compared to their student loans. A final category would cancel loans for Americans facing hardship that prevents them from repaying their student loans. The rule would allow the education departments to cancel debt for borrowers who are considered highly likely to default on their loans, and it would create an application system for individuals to detail order in forms of hardship. Do people need to apply? Most of the cancellation would be done automatically with no need to apply. Do people need to apply? Most of the cancellation would be done automatically with no need to apply. That would be the case for interest cancellation. Borrowers with older loans, those who had attended low-value programs, and those eligible for other cancellation programs. There's one exception. If borrowers want to make a case that they faced a hardship that merits cancellation, they would need to apply individually. When will people see relief? The Biden administration says some debt could be canceled as soon as this fall, including interest that has snowballed on top of borrowers' loans. That timeline would require some maneuvering. The Education Department said it plans to release a formal proposal in the coming months that would usually be followed by a public comment period of 60 days. Then, if the rule is finalized by November 1st, it would usually take effect the following July. But in this case, July 2025. But the Higher Education Act authorizes the education securely to fast-track rules for early implementation. In some cases, the Biden administration recently used that power to accelerate student loan cancellation offered through a new financial payment plan. Invoking that authority could allow Biden to start canceling debt later this year. Is this a sure thing? No. The Biden administration says it's confident that the plan is allowed by the Higher Education Act, but loan cancellation of this type is uncharted territory, and conservative opponents are expected to challenge Biden's plan in court. Republicans have repeatedly fought Biden's plan for paying student loan cancellation, saying it's an unfair benefit by those shouldered by taxpayers who repaid their loans or didn't go to college. Opponents say that the Supreme Court was clear that widespread loan cancellation must come from Congress. If Biden's plans faces a lawsuit, courts could order the administration to halt cancellation until legal questions are sorted out. That scenario could leave the plan on hold beyond the November presidential election. Even if it survives legal challenges, a Donald Trump victory would spell almost certain doom for Biden's plan. Now I'm going to read a bit of the NHL portion of this. So, Penguins boost playoff chances. Pittsburgh. Erik Karlsson scored 1-40 into overtime as the Pittsburgh Penguins bolstered their playoff odds with a 6-5 win over Detroit on Thursday night. Sidney Crosby set up Carlson's winner to become the 14th player in NHL history to reach 1,000 career assists. Crosby finished with a goal and two assists to move past Hall of Famer Phil Esposito and into the 10th on the NHL's all-time scoring list. Panthers 4, Blue Jackets 0. Sergei Bobrovsky made 25 saves to the tie for the NHL lead with 6 shutouts. Sam Reinhart scored his 54th goal, and Florida won at home. Bobrovsky, who has 44 career shutouts, is tied with Arizona's Connor Ingram and Pittsburgh's Tristan Jarry for the most this season. Flyers 4, Rangers 1. Bobby Brink scored the go-ahead goal early in the second period. Samuel Erson made 24 saves, and visiting Philadelphia snapped an 8-game losing streak. Islanders 3, Canadiens 2. Kyle Palmieri scored at 1-17 of overtime as host New York extended its winning streak to 6 games. Devils 6, Maple Leafs 5. Jesper Bratt broke a tie with 1-14 left with his season's goal of the game as visiting New Jersey overcame Toronto star Austin Matthews. So that was the e-news section, and now I'm going to go to the daily non-parallel online. So this is their website. Iowa and Wisconsin, Wisconsin State Journal. A bizarre and tragic scene unfolded Wednesday. A woman was found dead in Iowa, and authorities said a person of interest in the case, along with a 13-year-old girl, drove towards the Madison area. Along the way, they dropped a baby at Dane County home. During a police pursuit, both the man and the teen fled. The girl was found dead in the wooded area, and the man, who had run into an occupied home, was later found dead there of an apparent suicide. Here's what we know. What happened? A family in the town of Dunn South of McFarland called the authorities around 5:30 p.m. Wednesday, said that a couple had dropped off an infant at their home. Deputies later identified the pair as Alexander C. Grunk, 38, of Middleton, and an unidentified 13-year-old girl. Authorities found their vehicle and tried to pull it over, but the driver said it had sped away. During the pursuit, both Grunk and the girl fired guns at officers, authorities said. Sheriff's deputies used tire deflation devices to stop the car in Albion. The girl ran into the woods and was later found dead. It is not clear on how she died.
Grunk ran into a home. Authorities helped a woman and two children get out of the house, and deputies tried for hours to contact Grunk, who was still inside. Eventually, a robot was sent into the house, and Grunk was found dead from an apparent suicide. Is this connected to a homicide in Iowa? About 90 minutes after the first call in Dane County, authorities in Dubuque County, Iowa, arrived at the scene of a homicide. Tana Pope, 32, and her 13-year-old daughter and 5-month-old son were missing. Deputies learned that Grunk, a person of interest in Pope's death, was involved in a vehicle pursuit in Dane County. So what is known about Alexander Grunk? Pope, the victim in Iowa, had petitioned for the restraining order against Grunk twice in 2013. She called him a predator of children and was concerned about her daughter's relationship with Grunk. The girl told authorities at the time that Grunk was like a father to her, and her calms her down and loves her like a dad. In addition to the charges of child abduction, interfering with child custody, and domestic violence he was facing, Grunk has a criminal history that includes sexual assault, theft, and gun offenses. In 2007, Grunk, along with his twin brother and another man, were charged with attempting to unearth a woman's corpse and have sex with it. Those charges were initially dismissed since the state did not have a law prohibiting necrophilia at the time. But they were reinstated after the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled sexual intercourse with a corpse violated state law prohibiting sex with somebody who cannot give consent. And he was later convicted of attempted criminal damage to a cemetery, attempted misdemeanor theft, and attempted third-degree sexual assault. How were the homeowners in Albion? The people who lived at the home where Grunk died were displaced while authorities investigated. The woman's sister said the couple needed clothes, food, gift cards, and other help. Quarry Kennels, which is near the home, posted on its Facebook page that all family, staff, and pets are safe, and asked for patience while they regrouped. The next story on the website is, local family remains positive for the future despite house fire and theft. Tim Rawer, Council Bluffs, Nonpareil. Despite a devastating home fire, followed by a theft of personal belongings, a Council Bluffs family remains positive about the future. We have to move forward, Sarah Ferris told the Nonpareil in an interview. A situation is what you make of it, and we have to look to the future. On the night of March 3rd, Sarah, her husband John, and their daughter Kia were in Dallas for a cheerleading event when they received terrible news by phone from a neighbor. It was around 8:30 p.m. Their home on 7th Avenue was fully engulfed in flames with their dog inside. The neighbor then passed the phone to a first responder who asked if anyone was inside. Ferris said the only occupant was the family dog. "Don't worry, the dog was rescued," she said. John Ferris, who's driving back because of his job, arrived around 12:10 a.m. March 4th. By then, the fire was out, but not the misery it caused. "John sent me a picture by phone to prepare me," said Sarah Ferris, who flew back by plane the next day. "I couldn't believe it. There was glass everywhere. Everything was black and melted. It smelled so bad with the plastic melted. Every window was damaged, and the front door was on the lawn." The family moved in at Sarah's mom's house on West 4th Avenue, where they are currently staying temporarily. Unfortunately, the blows keep coming for the family. On March 24th, thieves broke into their garage, stealing many items from the fire-damaged home. "We took some things that we were able to salvage and put them in the garage, and then they broke in," John said. The thieves stole Kia's bicycle, a box of digital memory cards, and other valuables. Also taken was a candle that John's mother would always rub for good luck. "Nobody was hurt, so we're lucky in that regard," Sarah said. "Items can be replaced." A friend, Carly Golden, started a GoFundMe account for the family, and the community has responded, Sarah said. "It's going well," she said. "There's been a lot of support from the community, people we know and work with, and people we don't know. The generosity is something I could never have imagined." As of Friday morning, just under $13,000 has been raised in this account, with 114 donations already. Donations can be made at gofundme.com/f/the-ferris-family. Currently, the family is determining how to move forward. We have two options: either rebuild there or look for a new home. Whatever suits us best for the future, Sarah said. It's been a whirlwind, that's for sure. Our next story is The O.J. Simpson Saga Was a Unique American Moment. 3 decades on, we're still wondering what it means. By Ted Anthony from the Associated Press. New York. A dog's plaintive wail. A courtroom couplet turned cultural catchphrase about gloves. A judge and attorney who became media darlings and villains. A slightly bewildered house guest elevated briefly into a slightly bewildered celebrity. Troubling questions about race that echo still, the beginning of the Kardashian dynasty, and an epic slow-motion highway chase. And lest we forget, 2 people whose lives ended brutally. And a nation watched. A nation far different than today's, where the ravenousness for reality television has multiplied. The spectator mentality of those jumbled days in 1994 and 1995, then novel, has been an intrinsic part of the American fabric. Smack at the center of the national conversation was O.J. Simpson, one of the most curious cultural figures of recent U.S. history. Simpson's death Wednesday. Almost exactly 3 decades after the killings that changed his reputation from football hero to suspect summoned remembrances of an odd moment in time. No, let's call it what it was, which was deeply weird. In which case, a smartphone-less country craned its neck towards clunky TVs to watch a Ford Bronco inch its way along a California freeway. It was an incredible moment in American history, said Wolf Blitzer, anchoring coverage of Simpson's death Thursday on CNN. What's made it so beyond, of course, tabloid culture and the fundamental news value of such a famous person being accused in such brutal killings. The saga anticipated 21st century media. In an era where the internet, as we know it, was still being born, when platform was still just a place to board a train, Simpson was a unique breed of celebrity. He was truly transmedia, a harbinger of the digital age, a walking, talking crossover story for multiple audiences. He was sports, the very pinnacle of football excellence. He was stardom, not only for his athletic prowess, but for his Hertz-hawking run through airports on TV and his acting in movies like The Naked Gun. He embodied societal questions about race, class, and money long before Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman were stabbed to death on June 12, 1994. Then came the saga beginning with the killings, and ending only technically in a Los Angeles courtroom. More than a year later, the most epic of American novels had nothing on this period of the mid-1990s. Americans watched, Americans talked about watching, Americans debated, and Americans judged. And Americans watched some more. The generations-old chasm between white Americans and black Americans was not helped by Time magazine's decision to tactically darken Simpson's mugshot on its cover for dramatic, and many said, racist, effect. For those who lived through that period, it's hard to remember much in the public sphere that wasn't crowded out by the O.J. storyline and its many components, including the subsequent civil trial that found Simpson liable for their deaths. One newspaper even ran a series of possible endings to the storyline, written by mystery novelists. Sure, people were saying different things, but it was inarguably a national conversation. The nation and its media are far more fragmented now. Rarely these days do Americans gather around the virtual campfire for a common experience. Instead, small bushfires draw niche crowds in virtual corners for equally intense, but smaller, common experiences. This week's eclipse was a rare exception. In 1994, everyday real-time wall-to-wall coverage was still emerging. Sure, we had the Walter Cronkite during the Kennedy assassination, and again during the chaotic 1968 Democratic National Convention. And the first Gulf War in 1991 finally cemented live TV expectations. But coverage of the Bronco chase and the trial fed the appetite in a way no other event did. Even now, such universal viewership is rare. The media we consume is much more different now. It's so rare that we're all glued to the same spectacle, said Danielle Litterman, author of the 2022 book, True Story, What Reality TV Says About Us. In 1994, we were watching our television sets and following along with news coverage. Litterman's a professor of sociology at Lehigh University said in an email, but there wasn't that parallel discourse happening via social media. Connections between then and now. The connections between the Simpsons saga and today aren't hard to find. Judges and lawyers in high-profile cases are now regular fodder for the spotlight. One of Simpsons' attorneys, Robert Kardashian, paved the way for the next generation of his family to change the very face of how celebrity operates. A local Los Angeles TV reporter who covered the case, Harvey Levin, went on to establish TMZ, a luridly foundational pillar of modern multi-platform celebrity coverage and the outlet that broke the news of Simpson's death. And of course, as with so many American stories, there's a question of race. Simpson's acquittal on murder charges revealed a fundamental fault line. Some black people welcomed the verdict, while many white people were in disbelief. Simpson probably confused matters of more over the years by saying famously, "I'm not black, I'm OJ." But for many black Americans who felt their intentions with the police and courts had produced unjust results, the acquittal was a notable exception. There was a sense that it's only justice for a rich black man to get off when a rich white man would, said John Bake, a professor of history at Western New England University. 3 decades on, that conversation isn't over. He's certainly still discussing it with his students. On Thursday, Bake invoked Simpson to talk about race, fame, and wealth in class. Only after it ended did he find out his subject had died. A generation has passed since these events were fresh, and after thousands of hours of video, millions of written words, and countless talking heads weighing in, the O.J. Simpson case stands as 2 things. An American moment like no other, and an interlude that contains so much of what American culture is and was becoming. From the old weird America, it got the obsession with violent true crimes and its quirky cast of film noir villains and heroes, not to mention the tragedy and the whodunit. And it was a teaser trailer of the emerging, fragmenting internet culture that the world in a few years, given us smartphones, social media, reality TV, saturation, and live coverage is of just about everything. Was it, as so many said so loudly, the trial of the century? That's subjective. But any culture is made up of small bits, and the Simpson case left many of those in its wake. This is much incontrovertibly true. After the slow speed chase, American media culture got a whole lot faster really quickly. So fast, in fact, that many of the central questions around the case about race, justice, and how we consume murder and misery as just another set of consumer products linger unanswered. Where does this fit in? What do Americans think about this now? Bake wonders. What do you think about O.J. Simpson might be a limitless test for a long time still? There are 3 obituaries for today. So the first is for Dorothy Kelso from March 2nd, 1929 to April 5th, 2024. Dorothy Kelso, age 94, born at home on March 2nd, 1929 in Little Sioux, Iowa to Richard and Daisy Haney and passed April 5th, 2024. She married the love of her life, Arnold Kelso, in 1946. They had 3 daughters, Phyllis, Robin and Valerie, and 2 sons, Roland and Stephen. Dorothy, Dot or Dottie, gave her life to the Lord in 1963 and served him devotedly for the rest of her life. She was preceded in the death by her husband, mother, father, her 4 sisters, Louis, Ethel, Vera, and Laferne, and her brother Lester and her grandson Bart. She is survived by her 3 daughters and 2 sons. Many grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Funeral service will be held at 2 p.m. at Hoy Kilnuski Funeral Home on Friday, April 12, 2024. Visitation will be held an hour prior to the service. The family will direct memorials. Our next obituary is for Ethan H. Rasmussen. So, August 18th, 1928 to April 7th, 2024. Ethan Hald Rasmussen of Council Bluffs passed away April 7th, 2024 in his home. He was born August 18th, 1928 at the home of his parents, Marion and Marie Rasmussen at R.R. Neola, Iowa. He graduated from Beebe Town High School in Logan, Iowa in 1946. And in 1948, he and Maxine Lois Fisher of Neola were married. For 9 years, they operated Grade A dairy farms near Crescent, Iowa and Logan. During this period, Mr. Rasmussen served for 5 years in the Iowa National Guard. Discontinuing their dairy operation in 1957, the Rasmussens moved to the Council Bluffs, and Ethan began employment with a milk marketing and processing cooperative with general offices in Omaha, Nebraska. During the following 36 years, he held supervisory and managerial positions in the corporate, retiring as vice president and general manager of Western Operation of Mid-American Dairymen Incorporated. Throughout his career, Ethan also served as a board member for several state, regional, and dairy-related organizations. These included the American Dairy Association and Dairy Council of Nebraska from 1974 until 1993. He was further retained as a consultation for the boards of directors for these organizations until December 31st, 2009. Ethan was a member of Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Council Bluffs, where he served as an usher for over 50 years. Ethan was preceded in death by his parents and his brothers Bennett, Quentin Jr., and Roland. His wife of 72 years, Maxine. He is survived by his sons, Douglas, Pamela, and Sydney, and his sister, Rosanna, M. Russell, and nieces, nephews, other relatives, and many friends. Visitation with the family, Friday 5 to 8 p.m. at Coulter O'Neill Meyer Woodering Bayless Park Chapel. Funeral service Saturday, 10:45 a.m. at Our Savior's Lutheran Church, 600 Bluff Street, Internment. Ridgewood Cemetery with a lunch following at the church. Memorials are suggested to Our Lord Savior's Lutheran Church. Our last obituary for today is for Lisa R. Shafter. From October 18th, 1967 to April 1st, 2024. Lisa Shafter, age 56, of Stillwell, Kansas, entered into heaven on April 1st, 2024, surrounded by her family. On October 18th, 1967, a beautiful baby girl, Lisa Renee Collison, was born to Hilton and Mary Collison in Seneca, Kansas. Lisa grew up in Council Bluffs with her mom, raising her three children in the Catholic faith. Lisa graduated from St. Albert's High School in 1986. From there, she attended Morningside College and Iowa State University, where she met John and many close friends. John and Lisa were married on September 24, 1994, and together they built a beautiful life and beloved family with the blessing of three children. Throughout her life, she exemplified dedication, kindness, and grace with always a smile and joyful laugh. Lisa was the heart and soul of her family. Her unwavering love and support served as guiding light to all who knew her. Her devotion to her husband, children, and extended family was unparalleled, and her presence brought warmth and comfort through those around her. She was a woman of great faith and trust in the Lord even with the most difficult times. A woman of many talents, Lisa found joy in cooking and crafting, infusing love, creativity into every dish and scrapbook. Lisa's heart was genuine, and she welcomed friends and family with open arms. Nothing was more important to Lisa than friends and family. Most photos of her will be with her celebrating with them and talking or laughing during the picture. Lisa spent most of her work in life as customer service, where her caring heart served her and customers very well. Lisa's legacy of love, compassion, and generosity will live on in the hearts of all who are fortunate enough to know her. Though she may no longer be with us in body, her spirit will continue to inspire and uplift us each day. Lisa is surviving by her loving husband, John, and three devoted children, Drew, Faith, Lauren, Ella, and Mother Mary, and her caring brothers and their families, Kevin, Dava, Clausen, Kurt, Kristen, Clausen, and her nieces, Kaylee and Clarice, nephews Kenneth, Nick, Margaret, Corey, Jonan, Dylan, and Benjamin. Lisa was preceded in death by her father, Hilton Clausen, of Omaha, Nebraska, in August 15, 2023. She is mourned by many aunts, uncles, cousins, and extended family. A rosary will be prayed at 4 p.m., followed by visitation until 6 p.m., Thursday, April 11, 2024, at Porter Funeral Home, 8535 Moonriver, St. Lenexa, Kansas, and funeral mass will be at 10 a.m. Friday, April 12th at the Church of Ascension Catholic Church, 9510 West and 127th Street, Overland Park, Kansas, 66213. Memorial donations may be made to Kansas City Young Audiences or the Rebel Softball Scholarship in honor of Lisa Schafter.
Are you among the millions of Americans living with chronic pain? If so, you may think prescription opioids are the solution. The truth is, the benefits of opioids are limited. Opioids only mask the pain. Opioids also come with serious side effects, ranging from nausea to withdrawal symptoms to overdose. As many as 25% of people who are prescribed opioids struggle with addiction. And those who are addicted to opioids are 40 times more likely to move on to heroin. No one wants to live in pain, but no one should put their health at risk to be pain-free. There is another choice, physical therapy. Physical therapists treat pain through movement and exercise, no warning labels required, and you get to be an active participant in your care. Choose to treat your pain safely. Choose physical therapy. Visit moveforwardpt.com to find a physical therapist near you. This public service announcement is brought to you by the American Physical Therapy Association.